Those who can do, those who cannot do it on the internet. FancyPantsGangsters.com.
It's the Flyover Sky Show on the Fancy Pants Gangsters Podcast Network.
Yeah, yeah, this is King Django, and you're listening to the Flyover Sky Show on the Fancy Pants Gangsters Podcast Network.
Flyover Show can be found at FancyPantsGangsters.com and MNSky.com.
Hola, everybody. Welcome to another fine edition of the Flyover Ska Show. I'm Courtney. I'm the host of the show. And this is where I sit down and chat and talk shop and crack wise with the bands, musicians, DJs, and notables in the American ska and reggae scene. We're, of course, brought to you by the Fancy Pants Gangsters Podcast Network and MN Ska, Minnesota's ska community at MNSka.com. Before we get into the interview, a little programming note. I've been swamped and busy with work and playing with my band, the Prize Fighters, which is why you haven't heard my voice in many, many months. I just got out of the recording studio last night, in fact. We just laid down some vocal tracks for our upcoming release. It's not set in stone as to when and how we'll release that music, but odds are it will be set in vinyl. It's looking like you might have a Prize Fighter 7-inch or two coming to you in the near future. So that's something to look forward to. Other things to look forward to are more episodes of this show. I've already got some great guests lined up. But to tide you over, here is an interview I did earlier this year with resident Jamaican music expert Brad Klein. Or, he's better known as General Moses. Brad was a longtime reggae and ska radio DJ, and he's now working on the upcoming film Legends of Ska. Sit back and enjoy.
I think I heard about Bob Marley the day that he died. And I was like in high school, freshman, sophomore in high school or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was when I went off to college. I went to school in upstate New York in Ithaca College. And my roommate was really into Jamaican music or Bob Marley and smoking lots of weed. So I just kind of got into it at that point, and within a year I was the reggae DJ at the college radio station, which actually had a real big following. The station, it was really popular in upstate New York, and luckily there was a bar in town, a club called The Haunt, that used to also have lots and lots of reggae bands that would come through.
Hmm.
So the guys would come in from Jamaica. At that point, it was early 80s, early to mid 80s, and so it was all basically, you know, reggae and a lot of roots reggae they were into.
Yeah.
So all these bands would come in. They'd come into New York City for a gig, or Boston, and as they made their way west, I would stop in Ithaca. So it was just like, whatever, this little college town. And mm-hmm. It was great. So I was exposed to a lot of authentic Jamaican music.
Mm, yeah, so you got the live experience, and then I'm sure that helped fuel your fire as far as reggae is concerned with when you were doing your college radio stuff. So, I mean, it sounds like it's kind of a perpetual sort of cycle here. It's like you get exposed to the live music, the authentic stuff, and that is something that you can bring to your DJing and that sort of aspect too.
Yeah, again, I was really fortunate. There was a lot, you know, a lot of music at the station. That was when they had the main thing were turntables. It was mm-hmm. right as CDs were just coming out.
Right.
So there was a lot of vinyl around, and again, I was kind of schooled by some other people that had spent a lot of time down in Jamaica.
Mm-hmm.
And again, meeting the artists, I just got more and more captivated into it. It wasn't until. And then my first job out of college was with a reggae record label, a Ross Records in D.C.
Hmm.
I did publicity and promotion for them, and I was like a road manager for Eka Mouse on a couple tours, and I produced some stuff with like Yellow Man, and I mean, it was just, you had to do a little bit of everything, so it was, again, more and more into it, and it was very funny. And I didn't really get into the older Jamaican music until the early 1990s. I I started something called Reggae Aerobics and the World Beat Workout, trying to get people to exercise to reggae and all kinds of world beat music in fitness studios.
That is interesting.
Yeah, so I produced a series of cassettes because that's what instructors used. Mm-hmm. And everything was set up in the beats per minute for you to have an aerobic workout for a one-hour workout.
Wow.
So it had some soukous music, it had some ska, it had different kinds of African music, some Brazilian music, and again, it was all set at the beat per minute. So mm-hmm. songs was very specific. I'd be looking for a song at 126 beats per minute, which was usually like soca. I mean, that was all because they just set the metronome.
Sure.
And it just would go.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so I was doing that, and then I moved out to Southern California, and I was lucky to be, I was living in North County, San Diego, in a little kind of old beach town called Leucadia.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a great independent record store called Lou's Records out there. They're still there. And of course, not what it was. But they had a guy there named Studio One Dave. So you can only imagine. He was an old, you know, friend and fan of the Dodds and Studio One. And he was like the buyer. So he, for this record store, which was just, was doing gangbusters back then.
Sure.
He brought in, I mean, he had a great old knowledge of Jamaican music. So he would just import them from all over the place and really choice stuff. And it was really, I mean, I remember the list price on so many of the records, and I just started to get into the old stuff because he was really into the old stuff, mm-hmm. and it just, he had so much there. And I'm like, oh my gosh, it was like a kid in a candy store. And I was getting stuff for, it was like $7 a record, or I'd even get volume discounts if I'd buy
nice.
More. It was just like, so it was just like, tick, 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 tick. And I was really turned on. The more and more I got into the music, the more I found going further and further back.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and that's when I got into ska.
Well, that's interesting. So, okay, what led you to sort of the 70s reggae and roots reggae stuff? Like, what was it something about the music that sucked you in, or how did you get involved that way? And then, you know, like, for me, I started listening to punk rock music, and then through that, I found some, you know, punk ska stuff, and I realized, oh, this is a thing. Like, this is ska music, and that's kind of how I got hooked in. It was, you know, it was fast and it was fun. For you, I mean, what was it aesthetically about the music that kind of drew you in?
I don't know. I was into punk too. You know, I went to a bunch of Clash shows and mm-hmm. stuff like that. And a funny friend of mine just sent me a Minor Threat LP for the holidays. It was pretty funny.
That's awesome.
And it just ran. I realized I listened to some of that stuff now, and I'm just like, it's so far in my past of what I listened to. And but even the pace, it's just like,
it's a reminder of how far or how long it's been, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. You know, people learn different things at different ages in their life. Some people learn things when they're 12 that other people don't learn until they're 50,
mm-hmm.
or sometimes never do. But it's all, everybody's a different human experience.
Mm-hmm.
I just got into the roots reggae stuff. I just, you know, I love the message. I love the rhythms. And also having that one-on-one relationship with a lot of these guys made it, you know, extra special mm-hmm. in some ways. So getting to know them and hanging out with them and literally traveling with them and working with them on a record, it was a job, first of all,
right.
when I first got out. And then it was always just a passion and passion. But I was working in it in some ways. But again, getting... And then, I don't know, I came up with... I just was always working in some way with the music, and I went down to Jamaica a bunch of times actually in the 80s, and then I didn't go. When it was a job and everything else, I didn't go down there for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started to go back when in the early this century, what was it, 2002, I think I started to go back down before I was getting ready for the Legends of Ska concerts.
Mm-hmm.
And the great thing about that, I mean, I thought for that it was going to be the hardest thing was going to be to pull off that concert.
Mm-hmm.
Tracking everybody down was really fun. It was before Facebook. It was
yes.
before everything. So it was all through. You get a name, get a number, get a lead, and then, do you know this person? Do you know that? It was always like that
mm-hmm.
all the way along the way. And it's amazing. I mean, tracking the people down. Now everybody can be friends with anybody.
Yeah.
But you don't really know who is pulling you know, who has their fingers on the keys?
Sure. It might be, you know, relatives. It might be their representation.
Or it might be somebody completely different.
Right.
You know, because I know for a fact that certain artists are not, you know, have no, you know, Derek Morgan, first of all, he's blind, right? And he has a granddaughter who's just sitting there just buzzing around on like doing whatever, but...
Mm-hmm.
And you don't know is that person legit? Is it real?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I don't know, it's kind of bizarre.
But you went down there, and I assume made a bunch of phone calls, made a bunch of trips, and tried to get a hold of these people. How did you do that? Where did you begin?
Persistence.
Yeah.
Persistence. I was on Radio K in 2000, I think, when someone gave me Lord Tanimo's phone number, and I did a phone interview with him. And then I tracked down, who was it? Harry Moody, and I did one with him. And then I got Derek Morgan's number, and I did the interview with him in December 30th, whatever, 2000. And that went really, really well. It was like a half-hour interview, and I did those things live. And I remember I was in the studio, Radio K, with Alex Plastercaster and the Reverend Evan. And right after Derek's interview, it was right after the Buena Vista Social Club had come out, you know, and that was happening. It was very successful. It was a real buzz going on. That I was like, I remember turning to Evan and going, when is someone going to do a film on this music that we love? And it was just kind of literally that light bulb moment.
It's like something you can do. It's like,
I'm nuts enough to kind of do this. I'm kind of young enough. I think I've got some resources to throw at this, and because this is like a passion. I'd already, you know, I was teaching a class at the University of Minnesota in College of Continuing Education called Fire Down Below, the History of Jamaican Music.
Interesting.
That was great. That was really fun. It sold out the class. And every class, more and more people showed up because people brought other friends because they had heard about this thing. And it was just really great. And I brought the two turntables and tons of records. And we just covered the ears from the old days, full history, when the island was quote-unquote discovered by Columbus, all the way through to present. So I'd go, and I'd literally show them, this song was really big because of this, da-da-da-da. And I'd play, you know, a minute and a half of the song, and then while that's going on, I'd cue up another one, and it was just great. It was overload, and it was really good.
Yeah, I've taken a couple of, like, you know, music courses at the U of M when I was going there, and I always kind of wanted that, like, you know, I'm like, why wouldn't they just do, you know, Jamaican music or a ska reggae course, because there's so much there, and like the more you keep going down that rabbit hole, the more there's there to find. I mean, you can keep going and going and going, and that's really exciting. In the past few years, I mean, just hanging out with Aaron Porter, like, you know, he's showing me all these records and telling me all these things, and it's like, there's so much more there than you even think on the outset.
And as I was learning, and I've continued to learn, you know, the more you get into it, the deeper you go, the more you realize you don't know.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, and that's part of the good stuff. That's that's the fun, when you go digging and digging and you find out who was this and who did that, what was it? Just keep asking questions. And then sometimes I say, why are you taking, what are you writing down? What are you taking? I'm just taking notes. You know, who knows? I mean, every time I go down and reconnect with some of the artists and, you know, friends, I'm always asking more questions and doing this and that, where I try not to. Somebody said, you should film everything you do and everybody. I'm like, no, because when a camera's on,
it's inauthentic at some point.
Well, people tend to sometimes tighten up because they're on, and, oh, what's going to happen with this? Is this going to be on YouTube, or what is this? Whereas if the camera's not on, you get much more of a personal,
right,
real conversation.
Well, and from what I've read and the things that I've seen about the artists from that era, they're very, I don't want to say paranoid, but they're very protective. They have, for years, they feel like they've been taken advantage of. You know, some people think that they aren't getting their due, And so when if you got a camera on and you're trying to get something from them, they are a little, you know, guarded.
And understandably. Mm-hmm. And it's hard for you to maybe understand it as much because you're not still, you haven't experienced it yet, but as you get on in age and you realize all these changes that are going on in the world and these things that were around, like that device and this, mm-hmm. and I mean, most of the stuff that's in here is really within a short period of time and how vast the world has changed.
Right.
You know, and as you do get older, a lot of times, you know, you're more set in your ways and stuff. Some people are real early adapters. A lot of them aren't. I mean, these people, a model that I'm dealing with are in their late 60s, and most of them are in their 70s now, mm-hmm. where the world is, you know, is really very different.
Yeah.
And they don't know what you're going to do. And a lot of them, they don't know who a lot of these people are. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people, you know, that go to shows are, some are freaks, some are really great and sincere, but you know what I mean?
Yes.
You just don't know. Mm-hmm. You don't know what people are on. You don't know, remember, this is America. You know,
right.
Who's got what?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? You just never know. So people have, they have reason to be a little more guarded.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when you were, you were hanging out in Southern California, and you said you got into to ska via Studio One Dave,
mm-hmm. Who just passed away last year, actually.
Oh, really?
Dave Allard. Yeah.
What was it about ska that changed the game for you?
Well, I was into two-tone. I was into, and actually, so it was before the third wave. I didn't really know a lot about the older stuff. When I was at Ross in the late 80s, I was totally into the music now. It was mm-hmm. the dance hall music that was coming up at that period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, you'd be more exposed to stuff from the 70s. But it got like, you know, when all of a sudden all these records are available from Studio One Library, and again, one of the main labels in the old days, that it was all just like, who is this? Who is that? Who is that? Who is that? And I just found it, you know, the lyrics really compelling, the rhythms wonderful, nice to dance to. Again, everything wasn't all, we were talking about punk and all of that, mm-hmm. where it's really wound up and stuff. You know, this was just very different as I was just kind of myself evolving and my musical tastes mm-hmm. expanding, but also just, you know, really trying to learn more and more about it because I've always been a fan of history and
mm-hmm.
older stuff. And I've collected records. I mean, I'm into collecting 78, all different kinds of mediums, everything from 78 to 8 tracks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just it's all kind of bizarre. So, you know, then the more and more I got into it, the more I realized I didn't know. And I still, today, I'm always learning more stuff.
I feel like the progression of a lot of people is totally different of how you get into the music. Like I said, I got in via punk, but then listened to punk ska. And then that was in high school where, you know, everything is more or less, you're feeding off the energy. You're not really thinking about the music or thinking about anything else. It's just like, oh, yeah, this is fast and this is fun and there's horns and there's cool stuff. And then once you start peeling back the layers as you're getting older, I don't know, like maybe your tastes change or they expand and you start seeing more, that there's more to it than that.
Or they contract. A lot of people don't go, they're into music in college and then once they start their working life and everything in the family, it stops.
Yeah.
Almost to a curve. And you hear a few things, but that's it, and that's where it stops.
Well, yeah, and it's interesting because people come from it a different way, and when I've done interviews for the past couple years now, I've realized that, like, the way that I got into the music is different than the way that these other people did. You know, some people got in via Bob Marley and that sort of stuff, and some people started right away and said, well, my dad was really into, you know, these old, you know, Treasure Island records and, you know, just some really cool music that way. And so I always knew about it. And it's like, for me, I've had to work, you know, I've all that I listen to, I feel like I've earned because I've gone through and I've really, like, just it's almost like it's discovery, and you feel good because you not only are you listening to some great music, but it's like you've come a long way to find it, you know. And it's interesting that way. And for you, it seems like you're coming through a sort of a journey as well, because you're going, you're all over the country. You've made trips to Jamaica, and you're doing that same sort of discovery. I feel like, or do you feel that it's paid off, the trips that down there, the connections you've made, does that feed into your love of the music, or does it, or has it gone the other way, you know, for you? Have you been burnt out on it?
It's the journey.
Yeah.
Right, as they say. Well, the film's not done. I've been working on this thing now for over 10 years, and I'm making a real big push to get it completed this year. Specifically, I want a fine cut completed by the very early part of May. So we are in full gear trying to get this thing completed. Traveling around, I mean, it goes on. I mean, as a producer of a film, people just don't realize what, I mean, it means you're doing 90% of everything, and 90% of that is always raising the money.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, like I said earlier, I thought the hardest part of this film was going to be just pulling off that concert, getting everybody up there. I raised some funds for that. I had some to throw at it, and we were able to pull it off, where some people didn't think that was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But the hard part has been everything since then. Everybody always wants the next thing that you don't necessarily have yet.
Mm.
It's like, now my biggest chunk that I still need is, it's not really very much money comparatively, but I still need some money to get the synchronization rights, which are these song licenses.
Yeah.
Everybody always says, well, do you got all the rights? No, that's what I need the money for, to get those. Well, once you get those, come talk to me. Well, then I won't need to talk to you if I've already got the rights. So I'm probably going to a conference in a couple weeks down in D.C. at cable operators, and that's what they're just going to all say over and over. Well, what do you have to do? You have all the rights. But no, I'm looking for partners, and if you get me some cash and we have a relationship, then I will be able to have all those.
Mm-hmm.
But I can start counting right now. What everybody, it's all, because that's the biggest thing with music films, music docs, music films, all of it, it's money for rights. And now that, I mean, come on, record sales are been falling drastically. DVD mm-hmm. sales have been completely falling. That one of the ways that I get monies is either by touring or, get, you know, for those few films that really hit it big, that really pay off. I've established relationships now over the years with 85% of the people that I have to deal with,
mm-hmm.
aside from like Universal Music. You know, that's why you have attorneys to deal with something.
Mm-hmm.
But I've been burned out. I mean, and this is like the tough part of editing too, because it's like we've got so much material, we have so many things cut up and broken up, and so many buckets, so to speak, of all these different things.
Mm-hmm.
And my background is not in film. It's more in music and a passion for the music and these people and being a DJ and a collector and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I come at it from a very different way anyway. But it's exhausting. I've got so many different things to do aside from sitting in the room and editing it and going through stuff over and over. I'm always trying to find more stuff, trying to find more photographs. People don't realize, again, every single layer, every single frame that is in a film is treated, is touched, is massaged in some way.
Right.
And it's not my full-time job. I mean, I have another job. I'd love to spend yes. more time. I didn't think my career was going to be trying to make this thing, but I spent so much time and energy, let alone and money and resources mm-hmm. and... But, like, I was dealing with the relatives of Justin Hines earlier this week.
Mm-hmm.
I need some photos. I need a couple more photos. So I'm dealing with the son, his widow. At the same time, I'm trying to get footage from Keith Richards, who just did a thing with Dustin before Justin passed away called Wingless Angels, the whole thing where they were like this, his little group, troop.
Oh, yeah.
From Steertown and St. Anne's and outside of Ochi. And, I mean, all this week, it's like that was, and we have, I mean, wire money down there trying to figure, okay, I need these photos. I'll buy some photos from you. Okay, well, then they scan and they, which is nice, and they email me photos. I go, this is not what I wanted. I told you exactly what I want. You said you had it. This is not what I want or need. I've already got a lot of these. And I want photos from the 60s. I don't need stuff from the 80s. Thank right. you, though. But see what else you can find.
Mm-hmm.
And I've already sent you money. So people did very well. The ones who did very well were the ones that left the music business early on.
It's funny how that works.
Right. Well, you know, remember Herman Tsang, the piano player who was at the concerts, he quit the music business early on. And because he said he saw some of the older guys and they were just kind of always hanging on, not looking good, not having any kind of regular income. So he ended up working in the oil business. And they moved to Canada and worked, you know, it was a very nice setup. Patsy's done well because she left. She quit in 68. She went up to New York, worked at a hospital up on the Upper East Side in the cardiac unit. She actually was the receptionist up there for like 30 years and none of them knew anything about her, her past.
Well, so. That's interesting. Yeah, I had read Heather Augustine's book and it's funny because she interviewed her and she was telling me about how, yeah, Patsy had just basically left it all behind to the point where it's like, it was like locked in this vault of her past that no one around her, she didn't wear, you know, her music career on her sleeve. It was just, that was something I did back then, you know?
I went up in 2003, I think. I went to New York and I went and filmed her there before she retired. Actually, went and interviewed her in her apartment in Brooklyn. She had like 8 locks on the door. It was one of those. It's very bizarre. Filled. This thing was, room was just filled, and it was really warm out. In there, too, it was so hot. I'm just like dripping. But I also, like, the next day, I said, please just tell the people that I'm going to come and film you and just kind of give them a heads up. And it was very nice because there are all these beautiful bouquets of flowers in the cardiac unit for people that, you know, that are all over there. So it looks like it's kind of like right there in her little area. People are like, what is going on? And she had to tell them. It was very interesting. So I did a little bit of that stuff with her.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, yeah, she was very upset. And again, like I said, if you don't have a camera on, sometimes you get the real dirt and the real answers and stuff. And I said to her when I was just last, when did I go down to Florida? I think it was in October, I think I went down, or September. And I saw Dennis and her and a bunch of people. Yeah, I posted that picture with Patsy cooking the salmon stuff. We were sitting, and so let me ask you straight up, Patsy. I go, you always say that, you know, the greatest influence in your life was Mrs. Pottinger. That you owe everything to her, blah, 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 blah. But you also say that the reason that you got out of the business because you felt you were totally getting hustled was when you went to Belize and saw that your songs were 1, 2, and 3 on the charts and that you had no idea anything was there and you weren't getting any money from that or any royalties. You have to know or admit that Mrs. P knew about that.
Right.
Because she was getting the money for that. Whether it was being pressed in Belize or whatever, she was getting the spiff on that.
Right.
Those were not bootlegs at that time. And she said, yeah, I mean, I understand that she, you know, was doing some of that, but she taught me so much about, you know, being a woman, being a person, that I could take care of myself, and that I, you know, because I was a young girl in this business, and when I went around with Byron Lee, and I was just this young girl, I was like 14, and all the guys in the band, they'd do the show, and then they'd have drinks, and they'd go, you know, be changing or hitting on girls, and I'd be stuck on the bus or the van waiting for them to come out. It was not a glorious thing for me. People don't think about it, but she, you know, when the camera's on, a lot of times it's much more guarded, trying to think about saying something, you know, that's going to be, you know, really good and solid, compelling, and, like, earth-shattering, as opposed to when they're kind of more relaxed and just really talking to you.
Right. Yeah, it's funny how that works. I mean, I'm not comfortable on camera. I know.
You're aware when it's on. Yeah. When a guy's got it out, and the bigger they are, the more intimidating.
Yeah, exactly.
People get. So, yeah. So I try to go really low.
I can only imagine, what they're thinking at that point. But so for those that aren't familiar with the film that's coming out that you've been working on, why don't you speak to that a little bit? Maybe you had mentioned that the interview with Derek Morgan on Radio K kind of sparked the idea. How did you go from there? What did you do?
Let's see. I came back from the station and wrote out a brief outline of how I envisioned the film to be. And quite frankly, that outline is still pretty much intact of what I envisioned doing. I want to make this movie this kind of like chronological following of the early years of Jamaican music, like the birth of the music, the ska years. And now over time, though, it's now including, if you're going to talk about that, you got to talk about how it got to where it was. And since luckily it's not like I have to go back to the 20s and 34, I basically just have to go back 10 years to the 50s. So I'm, right now we're still tinkering with our sound system clip. So it's going to be a full-length movie, a full-length musical documentary. 90 minutes in length, but there's going to be one that's going to be an hour length. Like, this is how it all works. European cable operators, they want 52 minutes. They want a 1 hour thing. US, lots of different things are possible. We might do a smaller mini series of different things, different aspects, just looking at it differently, cutting it up. I mean, there's a lot of things I want to try to do with it. But the goal for the pyramid, let's say, is to make the film. And make it the best damn film I possibly can. Because, some guys get into this business and this is the beginning and they want to just keep going, this is the film I want to make.
Right.
And then I just want to work around this and keep doing it. And also this coming August, Jamaica turns 50 years old as an independent nation. It's a Jubilee celebration. So that's another reason why I want to get in. The real rush seems to be everybody trying to get everything ready and all these different things, all these different CD releases and commemorative this and that is all about, jamming it down the throats of people for early August 6th, which also, by the way, is when the Olympics are going on in London.
Oh, yeah.
With Usain Bolt and everybody else running wild on the track.
Sure.
Men's and women's track and field. So, I mean, there's going to be a lot of Jamaican-fication going on. A lot of just information and everything. But I'm now looking at it. There's going to be such a bottleneck right there. It's kind of like that first turn of the Kentucky Derby. There's going to be so many horses all crunching together.
Right.
Sometimes you can just hang back just a little bit. Besides, this has already taken a long time. So my idea is, it's the 50th celebration, but it is all a year. So I'm going to try to release some stuff just quietly at that point, maybe the soundtrack, but my concentration is during the whole year and then through that next year as well, and try to do a tour to support it. Again, most of the guys are much older now, and some of them have passed on. Other ones are unable to perform the way that they once were. So I'm envisioning a kind of hybrid band to tour and do some European festivals. This year it's just not going to happen because I've got to focus on doing so many other things, but I've got to get this film done and ready and apply. I got to start applying to film festivals. That's the other thing.
Oh yeah.
You have to apply. So I'm applying to some of the big dogs and we'll see. And once you get into that, then you can get invited. And then if we'll see how it happens.
Right. Yeah.
But the goal is to have a debut at the Toronto Film Festival in the second week of September.
And Toronto, that's where you staged the Legends of Ska concert.
10 years earlier. Yeah. Right. So, we can do the big party at the club, which has now gotten a major facelift from where we were. Which they said, Johnny Moore said to me, this club really reminds me of the old Bournemouth Club, which is where they used to play in East Kingston, where a lot of the guys actually were. The singers were in East Kingston. The most of the musicians were living in West Kingston. But so yeah, that's pretty interesting. Mm-hmm. And that's the goal. So, and again, the deadline is like June 1st, so I got to get that thing done. So, there's constantly so many other things that are going on, let alone having, we shot the concerts in, I mean, this is a lot of inside baseball stuff, as we say.
But, yeah.
You know, we shot the concerts in high def back in 2002. It was like the first thing in Jamaica stuff. So, yeah.
That's pretty cool.
So, it's going to look glowing. But in the meantime, it's just like pulling teeth so much. I mean, you'll spend hours and hours to try to get like 30 seconds of stuff.
Right.
Just right. So anyway, I know I'm kind of babbling a bit, but.
No, that's okay.
That's just what it is. There's so many things that have to go on and still other rights and other kinds of things. And so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sounds like.
I've always got something to do.
Well, but you always have stroked. You've always struck me as the type of person that when you want to do something, you don't mess around. You know what I mean? Like, when, you know, anyone could have come away from that that idea and said, you know, compromised or did something or, you know, said, oh, well, maybe just staging the concert alone would have been enough. But you were like, no, I want to make this. This is what I want to do. And I think for those of us who are really into this music or are starting to get into it or have yet to discover it, this film is going to be important. You know what I mean? Like, it's going to be a way for people to know more about it and not have to struggle to find information on it, you know? Like, this is going to be, and like you said, these people are mortals, so they're all, you know, they're all aging and not many are going to be around. So, I know, it's really great that you were able to capture, you know, their words and their viewpoints and what they felt about the music. And capturing that on film for the rest of us.
And that's what most of it is. I mean, again, it is still evolving, but it's like, it's a lot of people. I've interviewed all the artists. There were 30 artists at the concert.
Yeah.
And then there are the ones that I didn't have there that I've interviewed and put in. So I've only got a couple historians involved, and it's mostly out of the people's mouths.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of cutting of this and that, this and a lot of people that might go, who are all these people? You know, what is all this? But it's like their perspective on what it was and where it came from and who started it and what is ska. And I'm following this chronological path. So the order of the songs as it goes through are going to be the earlier stuff and the stories of some of those people, mostly about the singers, but also the band members. Get to see all these different people where it came from, because it came from all that happened down in Jamaica, but it came from so many places. It came from people that were descendants of Chinese immigrants that were brought in after the abolition of slavery in 1838. They needed more workers to do things, so they brought in the Chinese, right? So they're those, you know, distant offspring from those people.
Right.
Some people came from Cuba. Some of them came from Australia. The first engineer during the Ska Days of Federal Records was Graham Goodall. Came from Australia. Dennis Sindry, guitarist. People like, who was he? How did he get there? He came to go play. He was hired to play and perform in 1958 or 59 at the Glass Bucket Club. That was mismanaged and this and that. So he brought another Australian, Peter Stoddard. So, I mean, people came from all over the place. And then a lot of them immigrated to England. And ska had a big thing, those people that went there. The Jamaicans emigrated to England to basically help rebuild the country after World War II, since it was so decimated. Mm-hmm. That was one of the reasons why. And because they felt they had limited opportunities on the rock, that they went over to England, because it was also part of the Commonwealth. So it was easy for them to get into England. It's easy to get to Canada, Toronto.
Sure.
So that's why they did it.
Now, it's interesting. Now in this, it's strange. I seem to see a lot of bands that are starting to emerge, and some of the old Jamaican artists are still touring. I see that the what's left of the Scatolites are doing some U.S. dates this year, and then you've got when you guys were down at in November, when you guys were down in Jamaica, Aaron took some video, and you guys took some video of the Ska Rebirth band that Sparrow Martin is doing with the Alpha Boys School. So there's kind of like this next generation of Scatolites. I think Brian Dixon is doing some stuff out on the West Coast with doing sort of like a big band style of Scatolites music. So it's like, it seems that there's just recently, in the past couple of years, that there's just been a resurgence in interest in.
Here it comes again.
Yeah, another time where Americans are getting back into it.
Yeah, the early '60s. You had the late '70s, early '80s. You had the mid to late '90s, and where are we now?
Yeah,
2012.
Yeah.
So it's like it takes time. Each one. Mm-hmm. Or a different generation to discover it. Mm-hmm. So that's just it. This is now the fourth generation.
Well, what's interesting is it's different, though, than the other times. I feel like there's more of a...
That's good.
Let's tap into what was happening, you know, in the mid-60s in Jamaica. Instead of, you know, in the late 90s, it was kind of this strange hybrid of punk music with ska influence, but the ska influence was not from Jamaica more so than it was from the two-tone 80s era, you know?
Well, everyone is different.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, everyone is different. And people here, a lot of older people think that ska started in England in the late 70s, early 80s. They didn't even know that it had an original push back there. But again, everyone, circumstances are very different every time. You know, when Jerry Dammers, you know, formed Specials,
mm-hmm.
I mean, there was a real black and white tension going on in England at that time. It was just after the punk period, mm-hmm. punk era, which was 77, 78, into 79. 79 is basically when Two Tone had started, and Two Tone was just it there for a few years. And again, some bands kept going, but then it just had this resurgence again. And the interesting thing I thought about the third wave was how, I mean, that was really the early period of the net.
Yep.
And all those bands were wired, and everybody had a web page, and there were, what, 600, 700, 800 bands in the U.S. alone, and everybody had a site, and everybody was just doing it.
Mm-hmm.
It was wild. You know, and then also the swing kind of stuff came in. The swing revival.
Yeah.
And you had all the old curmudgeons saying, oh, it's not as good as Benny Goodman and the old one. Hey, anything that's going to get people to dress up really nicely and go out dancing. And swing is not an easy dance, doing all that stuff. I was so impressed. And those bands were great. I thought Cherry Pop and Daddies. Oops, sorry about that. All that stuff was fantastic.
Yeah.
And, you know, with everything comes at different times and different things are happening.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it was also, maybe the ska was also a response to the Seattle grunge stuff, which had so many years of...
Right.
You know, so everything responds to everything, and nothing is totally on its own, right?
Right.
It comes from something else. So we'll see. I mean, I think it's great. If these guys want to combine ska and rock steady with a big band kind of thing, I heard about that West Coast thing. Sounds fantastic. I mean, when I think about a hybrid band, I'd love to have some of the guys from the Hepcat.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the guys from the Specials, you know, boom, 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 with a couple of the old guys, we'll kill it.
Well, exactly.
We'll kill it.
Well, it's funny, and this seems like an idea that should have maybe came earlier, but I've always thought about, like, you know, picking some of my favorite musicians from some of these bands and putting them together and...
All you have to do is email them, call them up.
That's true.
And it helps to have some resources with which to do it. It's, you know, and you see people are at different stages in their life at different times.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them, I'm sure, have now got young kids. They can't do it, you know. Or just depending on where they're at, they finally have a real job, quote unquote, and
right.
You know, they're actually being able to like pay some bills instead of.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you have to know what motivates people. It's almost like an exercise in, like, psychology too. You know, it's like,
right.
You know what, you know. I've come to know that now. It's, you know, I'm in my late 20s, but the people that I make music with and most of the bands I play with and those, they're in their 30s, 40s, and it's like, yeah, there's different motivators there. There's different circumstances, scenarios. It's like you can't just say, oh, well, let's all go down and we'll
let's jump
a show
in the van and do a tour.
Yeah, let's tour around. It's like, no, it's not really that easy to do.
There isn't record label support like it always was. I mean, that's all the times. It's very different. It's very hard.
When I talked to the guys in Mustard Plug, they were telling me, and they're all, you know, they're 30s and 40s and they've got kids and families and stuff, and they're like, yeah, we've realized that if we're going to do touring, we just do weekends.
Or you pick your shots. Like, does everybody want to spend their vacations? No, because now they're married and they can go somewhere else on vacation. You got to really pick your shots.
It's like when you're in your early 20s, playing, you know, empty clubs on Monday and Tuesday nights because no one's coming out.
And you'd get those dates because they were open in the clubs, and they'll say, okay, fine.
Right. And so they said, we realize we don't have to take every show. We can, you know, pick what we want to do. And I'm like, wow, that sounds really mature and really smart. You know, it's like when you're a kid, you just want to play. You just want to, you know, it doesn't matter what. But it's like if you're doing it for money, or you're doing it for you need some sort of money, some sort of resource. You know,
right. And keep going.
Yeah,
let me just check.
It's funny too. I mean, like when we try to plan, you know, especially in ska bands, you have so many people try to organize a tour. It's tough because you know if you're in a 3-piece rock band, well, that's pretty easy. You got three
right.
people. But if you got, you know, 7 people, 8 people,
you know, oh right,
it's tough to.
And ska bands were always much bigger.
Right. Yeah. So. I'm really, really interested in seeing where, obviously where the movie takes you, and I'm really interested to see what becomes of it as far as a tour is concerned. I think that would be, I mean, that would be amazing.
But again, people forget about, like, it just takes money.
Mm-hmm.
It takes some partnership. It takes some other people willing to take some risks. And we'll see what happens. We'll see. I mean, I have not landed too many people that are just like, oh yeah, let's do this. It takes money to do things. And I'll do all I can to, you know, promote film and getting it done and everything and make sure everything looks great and all the I's are dotted, T's are crossed and all that kind of stuff. But it's going to take some effort.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to, you know, I always say my door is always open unless it's closed. I mean, this is not about me. This is about trying to do it. It's like, I know a lot of collectors, and it's amazing the mentality of collectors that I've seen of just kind of like this whole grab and hold and put it right in my stuff. And, you know, it's, you know, I'm like completely like letting it all go. It's like, whatever, do whatever it takes to put this music out and get the story out so people can really learn about it, and we'll see what happens. I'm in a different place. I mean, I got tons of work, but I don't care. You know, it's just stuff. I mean, I was telling my kids that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I got 15. My son turns 15 tomorrow.
Oh wow!
It's like, hey, it's not all about stuff. I mean, stuff's cool,
yes,
but it's all stuff. It's like whatever. Then you realize when you move, you put it all in boxes and pack it. You're like, oh god. I go, this is what counts.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't have your health, you know, you got nothing. So, you know, living in the now is really important. Planning for the future, thinking about the future, but living in the now and not getting too hung up on the past.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing that's been really great for this project. I mean, I was into anthropology when I was in college and history and stuff. And it's, you know, gerontological. If you're lucky, you grow up to be an old man or an old woman. And everybody's got similar, when all the old guys, when we get together, when I get to, what do we talk about? Health issues.
Yeah.
It's very different. It's very interesting. And again, you think about the diet that a lot of the older Jamaican guys had. It was never very good. They never had a lot of health facilities. So that's why every day, whenever I'm down on the island, every morning I go for a run. Every morning I just go and do it. And it's funny now that I'm now more comfortable in Kingston than any other place on the island. It's really weird. I mean, I just... It's bizarre, and also knowing that most of the people that I know and deal with aren't going to be around in 10 years. So, you know, it's good to diversify and that.
Yeah.
But I mean, I know some of, you know, the children. That's who I'm really dealing with a lot now, too. I'm dealing with the daughters and the last wives.
Sure.
Of producers and artists.
Well, yeah, for those that have gone already, I'm sure they're the ones that are controlling the
or fighting
the states or the rights or
fighting whatever. With other relatives,
right?
So yeah, it's, and that's one reason why I think no one tackled this type of project, let alone on the scale of what I'm trying to do. I mean, the BBC is doing another documentary on Jamaican music, and I know they're doing, you know, I'm sure they're going to do a lot of stuff. They're going to cover all kinds of cool stuff. It's going to be great, but my, you know, my whole film is about the old stuff, right? Nobody has, you know, the concert stuff, everything that I have, performances, because there's such little old footage. I think the BBC's got some stuff, but a lot of other stuff is gone. It's just not around. It's...
What's the biggest thing you think you've learned from this whole process? Like you said, you're not a filmmaker.
I'm becoming one.
But you're becoming one, yeah.
I say I'm a filmmaking.
Yeah.
That, you know, nothing worthwhile really comes very easily. And if you're genuine with people and upfront about a lot of things, certain doors will open and you never know what you're going to find. And you got to keep believing in yourself and listening. It's very important to listen. And, you know, keep trying stuff. Don't, some, you know, some people get to a certain point with a project and they just throw their hands up in the air. You know, I just never was going to do that. I just decided, because I've just spent too much, not just too much time, but that, been working on this music now for almost 30 years. So, I mean, and that's part of what I do. That's me.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's so easily relatable for me anyway. Like, when I started playing saxophone in middle school, in sixth grade, and the only reason I chose saxophone is because it was the only mouthpiece that I could make a sound on. And I just was like, okay, well, my mom and dad want me to be in band, so I'll be in band. And then in the seventh grade, they bought me a saxophone. And then from then on, I was like, okay, well, they bought me this saxophone. I can't quit. You know, they invested this money in me. And it's like, it wasn't that much money. But to me, as a seventh grader,
it was
like,
back then,
it's huge.
They made the effort.
Yeah,
you know?
It was huge. And so... And then through high school, I was like, okay, like, well, you know, so I kept telling myself, well, there's too much invested in me for me to quit now. So I got to keep going. I got to keep doing this. And it took, once I graduated high school and I had been in jazz band and regular band, and I was going, you know, going to the University of Minnesota, and here I was signing up for marching band at the U, and it's like, oh yeah. It's not because mom and dad bought you that saxophone. It's because you like to do it. You love it.
Hey, if you can score a band scholarship at school, oh my gosh, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if you tried that route, but I know, you know, hey, any way you can do it.
But, you know, and it was part of that, I mean, part of that, like, so me playing saxophone realizing it's really the only instrument I could play, but I always wanted to be in a band. It's like, oh, I could be in a ska band. Well, I find out more about ska music. Well, here I am today, you know? It's like, it's funny where you find yourself when you take the opportunities you take, and you're I don't know. I really, really enjoyed finding this music, and I don't know if I owe it to my parents for encouraging me to play music, or it's my friend for saying, you know, hey, you should listen to this Less Than Jake CD, you know. Whatever it was, it got me to this point, and it's interesting, and I get to meet cool people like yourself and other musicians and people who are just, when you talk to someone who's passionate about the same thing you're passionate about, it's just amazing. And that's kind of why I do what I do.
I saw in the Jamaican Observer earlier this week, eight guys, this photo, with eight guys standing up with a huge check, one of those kind of things, you know? And they were donating $150,000 Jamaican dollars to the Alpha Boys School, and they were giving it to Sister Chung, is the woman who's now running it. Sister Ignatius passed away like 5 years ago or 6 years ago, so this is the woman that runs it. Now, we met with her when we were down there. Very nice. But I'm like, a vinyl collectors club? Who are these guys? I've never met any of them. So it's like, you never know. I'm like, oh, I gotta go talk to those guys when I go down there. They might have some stuff. And again, I don't need records, but they might have a photograph. You know,
yeah.
I'm always moving on it and thinking about it. So it's, you never know. You never know.
Well, yeah.
Like I said, collectors can be an interesting lot, but some of them might just, and again, they're older guys. So maybe they're also at that point where, what do you got? What? How can you help? How do you want to participate? You know what I mean?
Right, exactly. Because at some point, the stuff just becomes stuff. And you
it is stuff. It always is. It really is all the time. You just don't realize because you just do into it. And then I get, you know, I get on, was it Boss Sounds? Right? Right. I get stuff every single day. Half dozen emails or texts from people selling things, and they're selling these 45s. Here, Boss Sounds for sale, you know, blah, 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 and they show a record intact. Here's some one record, 7-inch by the Creations, you know, 90 British pounds. To put these things, everything is like, how much are you selling these things for?
That's ridiculous.
It is my IRA.
Yeah. Well, if that's what they're going for.
Well, that's what I never see anybody ever respond. I mean, I guess they respond probably directly to them, but I'm like, what in the world? You gotta be kidding me.
Yeah. It is funny, yeah.
Anyway, so, yeah, it's a wild ride, and hopefully I'll be able to get this thing now. Get the first a rough cut and then a fine cut. I'd happy to invite you to, when we do like test marketing, test showings of the thing early on to get your feedback.
Oh, that would be amazing. That. Yeah. I mean, ever since, I think I heard about this project a couple years ago. I think Evan might have told me about it, and I've just been, I'm like, oh, I wonder what it's, you know, what it's going to be like. I wonder, you know, like you, I've been anticipating this, and I think, you had your Kickstarter project last year, and I think that kind of opened a lot of people's eyes to the project too. A lot of the people that are sort of the younger generation that are you know in bands touring right now and that are into the music now, I think they're aware of it now. So I think it's going to be interesting to see, you know, what happens, and I think they're also anticipating.
Did you see the recent phenomenon with the Five Iron Frenzy?
Yeah, I cannot believe that. Yeah, so for those who don't know, the Five Iron Frenzy, they're a Christian ska band from Denver, and they called it quits back in like 2003, and then they decided that they were going to make a return, and they were going to start a Kickstarter project to independently release an album, to record and release an album. And they started with a $30,000 goal. And
which is a sizable goal.
They met it in 55 minutes.
Last then, I saw it was 180,000 they were at.
Yeah, so they set this thing up for a 60-day campaign. And they, yeah.
Is it over yet? It's pretty, any day now it's going to end.
Yeah, but it's, you know,
but they're just killing it.
Close to 200 grand.
And that, I mean, the guy's video, it was really kind of weird. It was it was just all the lessons of what you're not supposed to try to do stuff. I mean, for what do they say, right? You know, it all depends on it. But it just shows the passion of the fan base.
Right.
People are into you. I mean, I busted my ass. I did two Kickstarters. I did one that didn't make it. I tried to get 50 grand.
Oh, yeah.
And I didn't get it. I only got to 15, so that's why then I did it in 30 days, waited, and then waited another 30 days, and then I started it up again, made it 60 days, and made it only at 15, so I just need to get to that. And some people that said they were going to come on board, they're like, well, wait, if you needed 50, what are 15 going to do? I'm like, 15 is going to get me here.
Yeah.
I still need this.
Right.
So I'd rather get the 15 and go than have nothing. And besides, it's marketing, it's up there, people can talk. And I busted my tail to get it. And these guys blew the... I didn't know it was 55 minutes. I mean, that's amazing.
Yeah. I'm just sitting there going, I wonder if there's, like, startup companies that are like, you know, what lessons can be learned here? Like,
I learned a lot from it. I mean, if you've got anything that's for this, the iPhone, or any kind of, for an iPad, or any kind of little gadget for it, all those people have tons of disposable income, quite frankly.
Yeah.
I saw there's one, I got the Kickstarter update the other day, an espresso machine. These guys are making a new espresso machine. They put their goal at like 25 or 30 grand. They're already up to 180, and they've already sold out. These are $450 units, and it's like, is it actually... It's all about a marketing thing now.
Right.
And you'll see. And then another guy I know locally is trying to do one. He's into, like, not just, like, that kind of Ultimate Fighting Championship stuff. I mean, the guys that are really sick. If you remember the wrestler, the guys that would, like, put staples in the guy's chest.
Oh, yeah.
He's, like, work with all those people, and he makes shirts and clothes and stuff, and he was trying to do something else. It's like, okay. They go, you got to go at it. And I told him all this, my own two cents on how to go about doing it. And he basically almost did nothing. And he's only got a week left. And he's only raised like $230. It's like, you gotta just be in it to win it if you're going to do it.
Right. Well, and this is the sort of thing where it's an all or nothing, you know.
Right.
Even if you do get pledged support, you don't make your goal, you don't get any of it.
Right. So I've sent out things now to basically... everybody except the people that had only ordered the DVD and soundtrack, which I'm going to throw in together, because to get people to buy two separate things in today's world in the retail is impossible.
Right.
So I'm going to combine the two.
That makes sense. And that should be
added value, yeah. And then incredible packaging that will have other things in there. So hopefully then it will spur people to step up and buy things. Hopefully. So by then, of course, I'll have something worked out. But it's just like, okay, I'm just, you know, got to go all over. There's an English festival. The biggest documentary festival is in Amsterdam around Thanksgiving time.
Mm-hmm.
It's all on the radar. But it's going to cost money.
But that's the thing. Like,
I'm trying to raise 100 grand. Hello. I could use 150. Hello.
Yeah, we have any benefactors out there. That'd be great.
You're there. You want to be a producer? Producer credits are for sale, baby.
There you go.
It's no question.
Well, there you have it. My conversation with Brad Klein that took place earlier this year. A little correction note. He mentioned that his film would be completed by sometime in May, but it is still in production right now. And just get a hold of us on Twitter, Flyover Ska Show, if you wish to be one of those producers and help contribute to the Legends of Ska movie. I've been Courtney Close for Brad Klein and Legends of Ska. We're all saying skank on.